The digital revolution that came to publishing more than a decade ago has provided journalists with reams of copy, virtual and otherwise, and maintained a healthy level of billable hours for antitrust attorneys. Where this leaves authors and publishers, though, is a subject for debate. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. Courtrooms figure prominently in the latest book world news, while one innovative online service struggles to balance costs and customer demand. And no, it's not Amazon. To sort out the winners and losers, Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, joins me from New York as he does nearly every Friday. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, as I say, nearly every Friday, because we took off last week for the July 4th weekend. And since then, there have been some fireworks in the legal realm. And so let's start with the case that we've already talked about quite a lot, as our audience knows, Apple and their e-book price-fixing trial. They lost a bid to overturn the 2013 verdict against them.
That's right. We learned last week that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, by a 2-1 margin, affirmed Judge Denise Coates' 2013 finding that Apple had indeed orchestrated a 2010 conspiracy with five major publishers to fix ebook prices. You can, of course, read all my coverage about that on the PW site, but I'm all too happy to offer my impressions here. And that's that, once again, it really wasn't close. The appeals court decision, like Judge Coates' decision, was really not a very close decision. In fact, the majority held that the verdict was amply supported and well-reasoned for the appeals court. Now, in the decision, Judge Coates' findings of fact, as well as her reading of antitrust law, were all pretty much broadly upheld. Specifically, the court upheld Judge Coates' holding that Apple had engaged in a per se case of price fixing. That is a case in which the restraint imposed on competition is so obviously outside the law that it's condemned without examination of other market factors, such as Amazon having a 90% market share. And that really is what the legal issue was in this appeal. And of course, the decision now paves the way for Apple to pay about, I think it was $400 million to consumers under its settlement with states in the consumer class. But of course, they don't have to begin those payments until all of its appeals are exhausted, and we ain't there yet.
No, we ain't, not by a long shot. And in this particular instance, too, Apple's complaints did not fall entirely on deaf ears. There was a dissent. It was a 2-1 ruling. So how sound a defeat was it really?
That's right. There was actually a dissent, and it came as expected. Last December, we talked about on this podcast how at the Court of Appeals oral arguments, which I attended, Judge Dennis Jacobs, his question suggested that he found Judge Coates' 2013 decision to be jiggery-pokery, shall we say, or perhaps pure applesauce, to quote a recent Antonin Scalia dissent. And accordingly, his decision disagreed pretty strongly with the majority. But the lawyers I've spoken to have been pretty dismissive of Jacobs' dissent. And if you read his dissent, it's not hard to see why. You know, really, it reads like more of a rant against the direction of antitrust law than a solid legal argument against Judge Coates' verdict. Basically, Judge Jacobs argued that since Apple is a customer of the publishers and not a competitor, that its vertical agreements with the publishers can't be seen as part of a horizontal conspiracy with the publishers. Now, Apple was competing with a monopolist, Jacobs believed. You know, it's like he referred to Amazon's 90% market share throughout, even though he conceded that there was nothing in Amazon's conduct that was unlawful, or at least proven to be unlawful in this case. This was just bare-knuckle business, he said. Basically, in his view, this was a clash of corporate titans. Amazon's behavior was legal, Apple's response was legal, and the publishers, yeah, they colluded, but they settled, so no problem. At one point, Jacobs even chided his colleagues for believing that antitrust laws were so easily offended by this kind of bare-knuckle competition. But in her written opinion for the majority, Judge Deborah Livingston took on Jacobs' dissent in a number of places, and she called it startling, and she sharply rebutted him. Competition is clearly not served by permitting a market entrant to eliminate price competition as a condition of entry, she wrote, and offering to orchestrate a horizontal conspiracy to raise prices, expressly to raise prices, is not a legitimate way to sweeten a deal, she noted. But at one point in his dissent, I will note that Judge Jacobs pointed out, he uttered some magic words. He stated in a set-off paragraph that the ruling of the appeals court puts it in conflict with other circuits. And of course, circuit conflict is one of those things that can get you a Supreme Court review.
Well, you know, a lot of things can get you a Supreme Court review, and everything's a possibility until it doesn't happen. But what do you think with the Apple case? Will the Supremes want to hear this?
I think it's pretty likely that Apple's going to appeal. At the very least, that it would delay the $400 million settlement. But I don't think it's terribly likely they take it on. The lawyers that I spoke to said that the circuit conflict case is pretty weak. But here's my take on this all. To be perfectly honest, Apple shouldn't appeal at this point. And there's a few reasons why they shouldn't. First and foremost, they're going to lose. You know, as one lawyer told me, this is a fact case, and the facts have augured against Apple at every single step of the way here. You know, in this case and in all its related actions. You know, seriously, we've talked a lot about this on the show. Apple has fought everything, including its monitor, and it has not had a single decision go its way in this action, not one. And that includes three trips before the Second Circuit for various complaints that they brought up. And as I said, I do believe that Judge Jacobs' circuit split seems to be pretty much a work of fiction in his mind. In fact, Judge Livingston, in her opinion, calls that out. Basically, she suggested that Jacobs is misreading the law. Whether that's intentional or whether that he's just misunderstands it is not clear, but she calls that out. You know, and there have been, like, this has been a long suit. There have been questionable hit jobs on Judge Coates. We've seen them in Fortune. We've seen them in the Wall Street Journal. And in the end, the facts pretty much have all gone against Apple. You know, I was not surprised by the decision. I'll add this too. But there was one surprise, and that's, to me, that it was so broadly affirmed. You know, given that it was such a hotly contested, sprawling, complex antitrust case, in cases like this, you would expect that something would have been called out and possibly even remanded, at least in part. But nothing was. Coates' handling of the case was pretty much roundly upheld. And there's another reason why I think Apple should probably let this go at this point, because after they lose at the Supreme Court, this case becomes binding case law on all circuits. You know, right now you have a single district court verdict and you have a settlement in the Second Circuit that's, you know, about to go into effect if they are to drop their appeals. So, you know, to get this affirmed at the Supreme Court level, that could complicate all of Apple's content businesses. So at this point, I think it's probably time for Apple to let it go. I doubt they will. But the way I look at it, the publishers have all moved on. We have the agency model in some form in place. Apple has the $400 million. That's not a problem. At this point, let their customers put it toward iWatches or, even better yet, ebooks.
Well, that's all for Apple for right now, Andrew. But in another case that we have spoken about occasionally here on Beyond the Book, the author plaintiffs who are suing Author Solutions for fraud were denied their classification as a class. And our friend Judge Coates was involved there as well.
That's right. Once again, this decision, I think, was pretty much expected as well, at least by me. As we've discussed on the show before, the case against Author Solutions was pretty much in trouble from the beginning. If you recall, the complaint had to be amended twice in its first year. Parent company of Author Solutions, Penguin, was severed from the case last year, and a number of the initial claims, including the failure to pay royalties, were dropped. The roster of named plaintiffs also changed, and that actually created jurisdictional issues that played into the court's decision to deny class action status. In January of this year, one of the plaintiffs, Kelvin James, withdrew, and that left no plaintiff in New York. And the final two plaintiffs resided in Colorado and California, and that required the establishment of subclasses under their state laws. So despite the suit against Author Solutions, beginning with eight claims, Coates' final class action analysis actually came down only to allegations of fraud in the California subclass. And in a 30-page written opinion, Judge Coates ruled that the plaintiff authors simply failed to produce the evidence they needed to back up their claims of a widespread nationwide fraud. Now, despite being denied class actions, the two individual underlying suits at the heart of this, they go on. But at this point, those cases are pretty small potatoes in terms of the legal stakes. Judge Coates' decision looms as a pretty big legal victory for Author Solutions. However, as we've discussed before, the company's legal problems, I think, are probably the least of its worries. Even though the authors were not able to present evidence that this was a systematic deception, the negative press and the attention to the shady practices, I think, has probably damaged Author Solutions' brand. And in an age with so much competition for indie authors, I think it remains to be seen how Author Solutions is going to recover from this. I mean, just go on Google and Google Author Solutions and look what comes up. And I would say that anyone who's actually looking to self-publish a book, at the very minimum, should do a Google search. The suit has also left a mess, I think, for the parent company here, which is now Penguin Random House, since the merger. How they clean that up is going to be an interesting thing to watch going forward. It's not clear to me that the company is committed to Author Solutions for the long term. So while this legal case may be winding down in the court of public opinion, I think that's where the real action is going to take place now.
Okay, well, finally, let's move outside of the courthouse and into some of the high rises there in Manhattan where the offices are. And a big announcement from Scribd. It's dramatically reduced the romance list in its latest subscription offering. And Scribd's been through a number of reincarnations over its own lifetime. Tell us about this, though. This is a new way of looking at their subscription model without as much romance as people were accustomed to.
Yeah, you know, I think this is kind of big news. So under Scribd's subscription model, once a reader hits a certain percentage of a book, the publisher gets paid its full list price. And, you know, we've talked in the past about the reading appetite of romance readers. And indeed, it appears that romance readers on the Scribd subscription platform, to play on a phrase, were reading Scribd out of house and home. Now, you know, around BEA, we had a lot of talk about the interest in subscription models and whether or not these models were going to be viable. And there was a lot of questions about whether Scribd's model in particular was going to be viable. You know, obviously, it's a brand new thing. It's a brand new way for people to access and read books. Some fine tuning was going to be needed. The Scribd officials will be the first people to tell you that. But with the Scribd news this week that they're peeling back on the romance list because so many people were reading, the critics have now pounced, and I think many people are suggesting that the subscription model itself is flawed and it can't work. But to those critics, I would say that they're probably focused on the wrong thing here. You know, I think what we should be acknowledging here is actually how much success Scribd has had in getting readers. The financial side was always going to have to be tweaked. I think we all knew that. But for Scribd, being barreled over by romance reader demand, I think that proves to me anyway that consumers really do like the service and that they really will embrace this. And I think the publishers see it that way too. This week, Macmillan announced that it's adding titles to the service. And so far, they've been pretty receptive to working with these subscription sites, at least on an experimental basis. Now, you can read all about that on the PW website. And I should also add that in Monday's issue, we're going to have a rundown of the most popular genre in unit sales. And no surprise, romance is right at the top of the list. And that'll be in Monday's issue of PW.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. And you know, Scribd really recovered this week. As you say, they had the big announcement about the romance titles, but the news from Macmillan must have boosted people's spirit around that office.
Couldn't have come at a better time.
Indeed. Well, Andrew Albany, Senior Writer, Publishers Weekly, thanks so much for joining us on Beyond the Book, as you do every Friday.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.